are listening to Radio Orbit with Mike Hagan on KOPN 89.5 FM.
It's the truth. You are listening to Radio Orbit on KOPN Columbia, and my name is Mike Hagan. Ugo Mattai is a distinguished professor of law and the Alfred and Hannah Fromm Chair in International and Comparative Law. He's also a professor of law at the University of Turin. His career is particularly remarkable to me because he has combined an impressive body of academic work with groundbreaking activism. We are privileged to have him with us tonight, and I am thrilled to say hello, Ugo Mattai. Welcome to Radio Orbit.
Hello, thank you very much for having me. How are you?
I'm very good. Thanks again for being with us this morning. I know it's early there. I believe you're in Italy, is that correct?
I am, yes. I'm in Lecce, in the deep south of Italy right now for 2 days.
Wow, it sounds beautiful. I feel that the climate there might be nicer than it is here in the middle of Missouri in the United States in the middle of winter.
Probably, yeah. Yeah. Right now here is quite pretty. It's not very hot, but it's okay.
All right. Well, I'm glad somebody's enjoying nice weather. All right. Before we get too deeply into sort of the news of the day, could you please, for people who are not familiar with you, give us a little background on who Ugo Mattai is and sort of how you got to be where you are and with the interests that you currently have.
I'm actually Italian. I was born in Torino, which is an industrial town in the northwest, mm-hmm. back in 1961, and I grew up there until age 22 when I graduated from law school at the University of Torino. Then I went on to get to the United States. I went to Yale for a year to study mm-hmm. economics. Then I went to Berkeley to do graduate work at the local law school at Bolt, and then I met when I was in the United States, I met with this guy who was a German emigre scholar called Rudolf Schlesinger, who was actually a professor of law at Hastings at the time, and that was 1988, and then ever since I've been doing back and forth. I got appointed at Hastings, and then I've been doing back and forth forever, basically. Every year I commute during the fall semester, and then I come back during the spring, and pretty much that has been my schedule in the last 25-26 years. So that's me, and of course, you know, when I'm in the States, I kind of get refilled. I do my research, my work, and all that kind of stuff, and then when I come here back to Italy, I'm usually involved much more politically, I do work mostly on the commons, which is all the struggle for common goods and that have been going on now for quite a long time in this country. That's pretty much who I am, and that is the part of my life which I enjoy. I mean, I enjoy both sides of them. It's quite schizophrenic. I do a lot of, I live in really in two different cultures and in two different worlds for extended periods of time. And that's my identity, I guess, at this point.
Okay.
Yeah.
The work that you do at the University of California, Hastings, could you talk a little bit about the research that you do there and how it might be related to your work with the commons? And I guess at some point I'd like you to do a reasonable in-depth definition of what the commons really are.
Yeah. Well, I started as a lawyer, but I always been a little bit feeling trapped into the law. The law is a very formal exercise, or can be so. And lawyers have been persuading everybody else in the world that the law is something different from everything else, from politics, from economics, from morality, for everything. You know, they've been claiming this sort of very positivistic status of the legal system, a system that lives its own life with its own people, its own rules, its own everything separated, and it's a specialist school. It's a trade school in a way. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. We learn a job, and this job is, however, is very political. Has a huge impact on society, and people think that the issues we deal with as lawyers are kind of the monopoly of a profession, and this has been so for the last for a long time, since probably the age of Roman lawyers and Roman jurists that invented all of this.
Mm, okay.
And me, I've been always trying to get off the libraries, to try to spend time studying more of the impact of the law in society, how the law works, what it does, how it makes us think, how it makes people believe that certain things are good and certain things are bad, all this kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And to do that, if you are a lawyer, trained as a lawyer, to get off the library and to do work in society, you need someone guiding you, because we don't have the skills. And so I always did what now became known called interdisciplinary work. That is to say that you work with someone who has a different training.
Right.
And I've been doing that since quite early. I started studying economics in the 80s, and that was times of, beginning of the neoliberal age. I was at Yale when Reagan was in office.
Mm, yeah.
And so that was a very particular time. There was a huge investment of money in academia to make it some sort of a ideological apparatus of the transformation that was going on. And it was, for a young boy coming from the semi-periphery, as someone who grew up in Italy, it was very difficult to understand what was going on. You were very trapped into the narrative. It was kind of cool, It was, you were young and ambitious and curious. So it was very easy to get trapped to believe the neoliberal rhetoric. It took me a while to understand that most of that was, crap. It was just a way of the winners of the social processes to legitimize themselves, to feel superior, to get it easy, and not to take any responsibility for anybody else.
Hmm.
So after that, was the time in which I was writing with the economists. Then after that, I started to do work with an important figure that was a professor of anthropology at Berkeley called Laura Nader.
Mm-hmm.
Laura is also actually the sister of great Ralph Nader, the activist and consumer advocate that in the United States is a key figure in the making of current American civilization. Even if people remember him only for the electoral, the run for office in 2000 during the Bush versus Gore campaign, and they blame him all sorts of things. But the truth of the matter is that the guy is really important for a lot of things that affect American lives every day. From the Clean Air Act to the safety laws on the cars to, nuke campaigns, lots of stuff like that.
Yeah. Ugo, pardon me. Didn't you author a book with Laura?
I authored a book with Laura, yes, back in 2008 called Plunder When the Rule of Law is Illegal.
Mm-hmm.
It was kind of a critique and a past the estuance, I would say, of the legal system. The book was an exploration in legal modernity and in the whole different narrative that over time made lawyers believe in themselves and calling themselves the rule of law and pretending that the law works in some sort of a neutral way, which is, possible to organize a society without people in a way, under law and not under people. And in fact, that is, one of the most powerful rhetoric of the bourgeois legal system, to pretend that the law is neutral, is blind, doesn't take into consideration relationships of power,
mm-hmm.
which is obviously a obviously wrong.
Yep.
False consciousness, as someone would say. Yeah.
Yeah. Wow.
So that's it with Laura. And that was actually really kind of a turning point in my career, I must say. Even if I was already active politically in social movements in a long period of time, I think that while writing, the period of writing Plunder was very long. We started writing it basically right after September the 11th, when Afghanistan was attacked by the United States with no reason whatsoever. Mm-hmm. And now it's coming out very clearly that there was no connection at all between the events in Manhattan and Mullah Omar and all that kind of stuff there. But there was a need to show strength in a reaction, and there were all sort of economic and power reasons to do that.
Yes.
And that has been a long, horrible war going on for such a long period of time. So we started then, right then, and we completed the book in 2008. The book was quite successful, much more internationally, actually, than in the U.S. In the U.S., it was okay, did okay, but it's been translated in, many languages, and it kind of introduced a different conversation about the sort of lawyers showing themselves as paladins of democracy and helping out the world and being do-gooders and all of that, while in reality it has been a long process of work in favor of the stronger and helping out in plunder of people that are weaker all over the world since colonial time and even before that.
Yes. All right. Let's talk a little bit more about the rule of law since we're kind of there anyway. In your book that we're speaking about, the book called Plunder, you actually talk about the rule of law being illegal essentially. And could we expand on that idea a little bit, how laws are actually used that way?
Yeah, well, the idea is quite simple. Is that there is a what later became known as a performative function of law. It is the law that decides what's legal and what is illegal in a quite arbitrary way after a process of production of rules, which are the way in which society gives norms to itself. And modernity has produce the law as I was telling before, as a positivistic ground, imagining it as some sort of a net, that decides human actions according to its standards. Some of those would be decided to be legal, and some of those actions would be considered illegal. But this sort of neutral check, neutral test, which is the law, which is not something that is political. It's something that is, lawyers use a term that is called autopoietic, that is to say it actually produces itself.
Mm-hmm.
And all of that, is simply a way to introduce quite a lot of arbitrariness in society, and basically the rule of the stronger. The stronger parts of society which organize themselves usually in lobbying interests of a variety of kinds, are able today to hijack the legal system quite a bit.
Yes.
They are able to have law which is not in the common interest, and we are here beginning to talk about the idea of the commons and what is common. Laws that are not in the common interest but are in the private interest are passed through the process. And once a law becomes law, once this private organized interest, which we call the political process, and that we study in academia as a field of study which is separated from the field of the law, becomes the domain of a political scientist. Okay? So it's a completely different, it's a completely arbitrary, artificial differentiation of the same thing. The way in which society decides the rules from itself, which we could call, generally speaking, starts from the moment in which a political process produces these rules. These rules become law, and then these rules are applied in society. And this process is divided up. Modernity has divided up this in different, we call them social sciences. Okay? Mm-hmm. So political science studies the beginning, from the beginning of the political process to the moment in which it becomes law. then there is the magic moment in which the political process becomes law in Western society. It's, you know, with the enactment of law, the act of enacting it, meaning when it actually stops being a political struggle and becomes, you know, basically gets into the forms of the law, usually after a vote in parliament or after a decree of the president. It depends from the different ways. Mm-hmm. And then from that moment, all what is behind, all the forces that are behind the law disappear, kind of magically. We don't know anymore that is the outcome of political activity that has produced rules that have nothing to do with being fair, or being, you know, in the common interest, or being just. They are just law. But the fact that they become law makes them beyond critique from the point of view of ethics, of morality, of economic interest, or of political pedigree. We basically forget everything, and at that point is the moment of lawyers. You know, lawyers come into the picture and start working on that.
Yeah.
And whatever happens in society because of that, again becomes the province of someone else. I'm not lawyers that study that, are sociologists, for example. You know, again, another department, another tradition, another intellectual elite that does its own approach to the same process. So if you look at it in a dynamic way, you see the same thing that becomes parcelized, becomes divided in different professions. And all of this has basically a very simple impact, and that is what is called depolitization, you know, making the law unpolitical or apolitical, and making everybody think that is some sort of a natural thing that exists outside of a real act of will of the polity.
Yeah.
And this is where, you know, illegality in the legal system can stay, because you know, if you don't consider the impact of the law on society, if you don't consider the whole process, but you just kind of crystallize a moment, that particular moment is beyond critique, okay? And we show in Plunder, basically, we start a process. Now, I have a lot of, most Laura went on with her own work. I did mine after that. But, you know, that was a quite important point, because for her, as an anthropologist, it was to understand, you know, that Santa Claus doesn't exist in a way. Yeah. You know, the legal system as a sort of positivistic entities that exist as such is just a creation, an invention. Mm. And for me, it was a very important moment to think about consequences on what are known as the people without history, basically. Mm. What historically the role of law in plundering societies, in genocides, in creating all sorts of, you know, worldly structures of domination, while pretending that we were acting legally.
Yes.
Okay? So that tension, we followed that tension throughout the years and throughout the, you know, the centuries, and all the way to you know, that was the book was published in 2008, right before the economic crisis. Mm. And we did that both taking into consideration you know, history of genocides and history of, you know, plunder of gold and plunder of oil and all the kind of things like that, and, you know, the more sophisticated techniques that are going on now, basically put the capitalist hands in the pockets of the consumers, all the way to mercy to make the consumers become commodity themselves, which is happening now. That at the time was much far away from our radar, which is, you know, basically the technological transformation. So that all of that is the topic of the idea of the rule of law is illegal.
Mm, okay.
Currently, you know, after that, my focus was on trying to develop a pars construens, I would say, you know, was just not only a critique, but something also that was a little less depressive, because I've been, you know, touring the world with Plunder. It was really a big occasion of traveling because it was translating so many places, and wherever a translation would come out, you know, you'd be invited and give a talk. And,
right, right.
And it was pretty depressive, you know. Yeah. It's like getting to a bunch of kids that believe in Santa Claus and explaining them it doesn't exist. It's not fun.
Yeah. Yeah, the truth hurts sometimes, right?
Yeah, and so that was, you know, and that's really pretty much why I sort of tried to work out what then came out in another book more recent in 2016 that I wrote with an ecologist, Fritjof Capra, and the book is called The Ecology of Law.
Yes,
and the idea was to try to make the legal system, as we say in the subtitle, back in tune with nature and community. In other words, making Santa Claus again, you know, something that exists in a different way.
Yes.
That, you know, not a critique of law as such, but a critique of the way in which law worked historically, but also showing the possibility of retune it because it cuts away. You know? If you think about it, take an example, just a simple example that Americans would understand very clearly because it's part of their deep history. Think about Rosa Parks. Mm. Rosa Parks refusing to leave her seat in the bus in Alabama.
Yes.
Was doing something illegal. Okay?
Yeah.
But that very it was clearly legal, but that very same act of resistance generated a completely new development in the law.
Yes.
So you see, an illegal act produced new law, new transformation, new sensitivity, new culture. And this is pretty much, you know, where we're trying to go. And she was, you know, conscious of the fact that the law was illegal.
Mm-hmm.
There was a whole, you know, organization around her. Nothing is just left to the chance. You know, the NAACP was very, very careful in picking her as a case, you know, because she was a very special person in the community, very respected, all of that. And so they had to show, it was important to show that crazy legal system that was apartheid in the United States was hitting people that were not bad people, you know, so that you could create another kind of mentality. So today, I think we are pretty much at that point in a sense. The young girl, Greta Thunberg, the one who is in Europe, is very hot. I know she went to the United States. The young Swedish girl that...
Yes, yes, we're familiar.
...sat in front of the parliament, you know, and who is inspiring the global movement of students against climate change. She's a symbol like that, you know. She's basically saying, look, you know, we now go out producing laws that are illegal because they are destroying our planet, and it's not that the planet is destroyed by some bad people. You know, it's not that it's destroyed by some illegal activities in the formal sense. It is destroyed by perfectly legal behaviors of, you know, large corporations, large actors that pollute badly, and even ourselves when we, you know, keep our SUVs saying, well, you know, the gas I'm consuming is mine, but in fact, you know, the result is an activity which is an ecocide, and as such should be legal, should be declared so, should be understood and resisted, basically.
So let's talk about the relationship between ecology and the commons.
Well, you see, the commons is a very... You asked me before a definition. The commons is not really something that is simple to define. Most of, you know, the Western people, the American people and the semi-periphery that is today, so to say, in the cultural hegemony of the United States, which includes my own country, or includes Europe, the so-called semi-periphery of the world, are used to study the commons with a story that was published back in the 60s by a guy called Garrett Hardin, that was called the tragedy of the commons.
Yes.
The tragedy of the commons, meaning that when something is common, it's going to be overused, it's going to be overexploited because there is some natural instinct on us to be selfish, to be egotic, and to consume as much as possible of whatever is in front of us. And therefore, the commons are going to be destroyed unless something magic happens, and this something magic is construct a structure of power that we call the law that can have either the form of property, of private property, or the form of government. Okay, that's how the story goes. Mm. If there is no private property, no government, no top-down regulation of something that is available to everybody, this something is going to be damaged and overused because our nature is the nature of predatory beings.
Okay.
That's the tragedy of the song.
Yes, okay.
And that has been extremely internalized. It was an article that has an incredible success. Was very banal in its own way, very, very beautifully written, and also an article that not many people read, but most people know what it is about vaguely, was published on Science, most famous scholarly journal in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
And for years, you know, we all kind of assumed that we needed these two institutions, the private property or the state, which were basically the two fundamental institutions of modernity. Okay, modernity, which is to say, you know, after humanism in the 16th century and during the Industrial Revolution and all of that, the process was that of transformation of the commons, which is everything that was not regulated directly by the state, either into private property or into direct state sovereignty. That's the way in which we made the modern world in the West.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
And that is the grammar of our mind when we think about everything that has to do with politics in the broadest sense of the term. If you think about it, even the idea of right and left, you know, the right being more for private property and left for state. And for government, the left being the right, and the left being more for government and less for private property.
Yeah.
Assume this sort of zero-sum game. Either it's private property or it's public government and domain. Either it's market or it's state. You know, there is this binary vision.
Mm.
In the middle of that, in fact, there is the commons. The commons are resources, things in the broader sense of the term, that are neither private property nor government, but are actually directly the way in which the people live together,
yeah.
Organize institutions, structures of exchange, of relationship. Okay.
Okay.
And so those institutions have been the big losers of social processes, because the more this binary vision extends itself in modernity, the more these institutions, these intermediary institutions in which people cooperate, live together, you know, the village culture, the greens, or even, you know, the larger family institutions or the many of institutions of solidarity like co-ops and stuff like that, they all kind of lose their ground, either to private property in the today in the form of the corporation, or to government institution in the form, you know, of a top-down kind of regulation.
Okay.
The commons are very much connected, however, with the environment, because they are based on use value. If you imagine the world before modernity, before the so-called enclosures in England, which is the making of private property under the under the control of the state, before the enclosures, there were huge amounts of commons. You know, the forest, for example. The
yes.
forest is a place where everybody could enter and pick up, you know, wood and hunt and get, you know, fish get strawberries and, you know, berries or whatever. You
right.
know, so it was basically the commons are based on access, on free access.
Yes. Okay.
And there is very, very public squares are commons. Okay, in some sense, you know, people can go there. and meet each other. And the square exists as a place of access, not as a place of exclusion.
Yes.
Today, we have no squares. In the United States, for example, there are no places in which, or very, very little places in cities where people can just go and stay and exchange. They are privatized.
Yeah.
You know, they are all part, either they are, you know, shopping malls, which are private, and in which if you want a seat, you have to consume some coffee at Starbucks or wherever. And if you are someone who doesn't have the money to buy a space, you're just kicked out of there.
Mm.
You know? Or there are not places in which you can exchange political ideas.
Yeah.
If you're in a shopping mall and you try to tell to the people, you know, get involved, be active for the environment, and so on and so forth. A private cop will come there and say, would you go out of here? Here people are supposed to go and shop and spend money, not to talk about, think about politics.
Yes.
So
yeah.
All of that has been disappearing in the last 250 years in a very dramatic way. And all the commons have been translated into capital. This is a very crucial passage.
Okay.
You know, the use value, the access to the use, has been transformed in exchange value. So the commons have been transformed into capital over and over and over again. And the legal system has assisted this transformation.
Okay.
The most important role of the law has been transforming commons into capital by constructing institutions that make this great transformation natural. Okay, institutions such as private property, the most important, but also freedom of contract, or responsibility by fault, or limited liability corporations. You know, all of those things have a purpose, and the purpose is transform commons that were overabundant into capital that 200 years ago was not enough. Okay,
wow.
The apotheosis of that was the making of the American Constitution. You know, the American Constitution, the American frontier, has been the place in which the most advanced experimentation in the construction of a modern society could be performed. And you know, and in fact, prominent in the U.S. Constitution, you find what. Two things, government, you know, division of power and government, Article 1, 2, and 3, and private property.
Yes.
The two big institutions. And society is organized around that idea. Now, it might have been a good idea back in the, from a certain perspective, back in the 18th century, because there were so much commons and so little capital. Europe was covered with forests.
Yeah.
The state had no capacity to govern the village. The villages where there was a huge amount of diffusion of power, which is a typical thing of the commons. So this transformation of commons, of use value to exchange value, of commons into capital, was necessary, you can say, for human development, because, you know, we needed to concentrate capital to create hospitals and universities. There was a need of that.
Mm-hmm.
But today, you know, we are in the completely opposite situation. Today we have a massive amount of capital. The world has concentrated capital beyond any prior historical time.
Right.
Capital is huge. It's very badly distributed, but it's huge.
Mm.
You know, guys like Steve Bezos or Zuckerberg by themselves control an amount of capital that is worth, you know, more than the need of, you know, 50-60% of their fellow Americans. We're talking about obscene amounts of capital concentration.
Yeah, it's
crazy.
And
the commons are all suffering, There is no commons, both ecological and in terms of social relationship, that is not in a state of bad suffering. You know, our fisheries are in extinction. The forests are dying and burned. You know, you name it.
Mm.
People are completely individualized. There are no social structures different than, you know, the political relationship based on election every 4 or 5 years. So. But we still have the very same legal system of 250 years ago. So today, What we would need would be a legal system that gives incentive to go in the opposite direction, to transform this enormous capital into common. Okay? We don't need today a legal system that allows more transformation of commons that are basically dying into more capital. Okay? But we still have those rules. So there is a huge responsibility, you know, of political theory, of law, of, you know, of political visions to give instruments to make this transformation from common, from capital into commons happen as a natural way in which individuals perform and lead. You know, as it happens to 250 years ago from commons into capital, it must happen today from capital into commons.
Right.
That's the only way, I believe, in which we can reconstruct some, you know, sustainability and some possibility of the planet to be passed by to future generations.
Okay.
But we are doing the opposite.
All right. Well, let's say to the listeners that they are listening to KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM. This is Radio Orbit. My guest tonight is Professor Ugo Mattei. And we're talking about the wealth of the commons. Professor Mattei, if people are interested in information about you, I couldn't find an actual website with your name, but I know that you are a contributing author at the Wealth of the Commons, and I've got a link to that site. Is there any place else where we might direct people to find more of your work?
Well, I have a selected work place on the press. If you type on Google something like Ugo Mattei selected works, you will get, you know, most of my scholarly articles. You know, I'm pretty much on YouTube, even if mostly in Italian, because a lot of the stuff I do. But there are some stuff in English. There are a variety of places in which you can easily access me. I don't know actually, you know, because today, it's not like once upon a time in which you'd say, oh, if you type something on Google, that comes out. All the sites are personalized, therefore I have no idea what happens in Missouri if you write Ugo Mattei on Google. I suspect there is going to be my, you know, I think there is probably something about Hastings or something like that. It's just a matter of looking a little bit, and you'll find me. I'm pretty much there. I'm not on social media though. I'm not on Facebook. I'm not on Twitter. I'm not there.
Okay, good. You know, that's one of the things that I was going to ask you about: technology, social media, smart devices. Yeah. You've had some pretty interesting things to say about those things in the past. Perhaps we could chat a little bit about that.
Absolutely. Let me just, before we get into that, give me 2 minutes to answer your previous question, because I became so long and verbose that I didn't get there. I'm sorry. So what is the role of the commons into the legal system? I believe that the commons are today, you know, institutions that are based on two principles, which are the principle of access and the principle of a diffusion of power. And these two principles are the polar opposite of the principles of the legal system of modernity. Today, the law is based on exclusion. You know, either you're legal or you're illegal, or either you're in or you're out.
Yes.
Either you are on this side of the wall or you're on the other side of the wall at the frontier in Mexico. Either you are in your property or you are trespassing in the law of property. See, so exclusion is the most important structure of the legal system today, both of government and of private property.
Okay.
And concentration of power is the other strong fundamental principle. You know, government, President Trump, for example, claims that he doesn't have enough power. You know, and you want to concentrate more and more in the hands of the executive. This is not something that happens only in the United States. You know, that then the Supreme Court becomes, in a way, controlled by the government. The concentration of power is really what's going on now. If you think about how the law is ruled today, how the world is ruled today, you have very strong people with a lot of power running very large territories. President Putin in Russia, or President Trump in the United States, or in China, everywhere. The structure of control is concentration of power. Okay.
Yeah.
Now, the commons is the opposite of all of that. It's diffusion of power. It's making people directly in charge of their stuff and having, you know, direct access to resources, being responsible in using them in a non-tragic way. There is no inherent tragedy in the commons. There is just self-organization, autonomy, capacity to give yourself rules that respect each other. There is that. And there is also access. The fundamental principle is not exclusion, but it's access. It's the idea of collective intelligence, the idea that if we do stuff together, many people are smarter than one people. You know, the collective intellect is more powerful than the very smart guy. Okay,
yes.
So this and all of that can be translated into law. The law doesn't necessarily need to be based on the exclusion and concentration of power. You can imagine a legal system based on access and diffusion of power. And the institutions of the commons are all those institutions that try to give direct power to the people in ways that is, of course, principled. It's, of course, coherent with, you know, a vision, coherent with a shared vision, which is, you know, most of the time the constitutional vision of the people of a certain country. So there is a huge importance of the commons in the legal system, in remaking the legal system, in changing direction of our development. The law is still crucial, but the law has to be based on different principles, and those principles are the principles of the commons. Okay, so that's to answer your previous question.
Okay, very good. You know, before we go to social media and stuff, though, I do want to comment that you mentioned Hardin's essay on tragedy. There's one that I came across from you that's maybe 8 or 9 years old. It's called The State, the Market, and Some Preliminary Questions About the Commons. That one I thought was very thought-provoking. Maybe you could chat a little bit about your thoughts when you were writing that and the purpose.
Well, you see, basically, Garrett Hardin was the dominant paradigm for a long period of time until an American woman called Elinor Ostrom appeared on the international scholarly scene, and she wrote a book that was called Governing the Commons, a very famous book in 1990. She started the work in 1990, and the book, I think it was published sometimes in 1990, later, the last part of last century.
Okay.
And then she published extensively on that, and finally she got the Nobel Prize in Economics in 2009. And she basically went around the world to check all those places in which the use of the commons by the people was not tragic, in which there was no tragedy going on, even if there was neither private property nor government.
Okay?
And she produced quite a lot of evidence to say, well, you know, Mr. Garrett Hardin, I'm sorry, but that's just ideology. That's not the way in which necessarily people behave.
Okay?
And so that really was a paradigm shift. And it became, and when the crisis hit in 2008, it was not casual that the Nobel Committee picked her as the Nobel Prize winner, actually the first woman ever, because she was basically pointing at something that was a very fundamental aspect of the capitalist system, to believe in the tragedy of the commons, to justify the...
Yeah.
So my own work there entered to introduce another more, in a way, it was less academic. I've been working on the commons. I started working on the commons much more as an activist than as a scholar. So when I was, you know, after I wrote Plunder and they published Plunder in 2008, it was pretty much it came out at the beginning of the economic crisis. And I was depressed by my scholarly findings, and I thought that it was the moment of being involved in activism, and I got involved very much in the water movement. There is a global movement against privatization of water,
yes,
which is extremely important.
Is one of the
aspects of our current war that are going to likely destroy us, which is giving the control of the water supply system to big multinational interests and corporations. That's a disaster, because whoever controls water for people is basically controlling the people completely.
Absolutely. Yes.
We can live just 3 days without water. You know, it's just a huge power. The control of the water supply system is a huge, huge power, a way to exercise power. We don't realize that anymore because we just opened in the lucky part of the world, we just open the faucet and the water comes out, so we don't even think about it.
Yes.
But that's really the most important structure of actual control over people, of someone. If you take away water to someone in an apartment, after 3 days will die or will come out of there. So it's a strategy of sieging people, obliging people to do stuff. It's very powerful.
Yes, it is.
And we don't think about it on those terms. And in Italy, for example, in Italy there was a big attempt to privatize the all water supply system that was traditional in public hands back in 2009. And I basically led a nationwide movement there. We got 27 million people voting against water privatization. It was a major success. It was a major political moment. It was certainly the most important thing I ever did in my life.
How did you do it?
Just organize a referendum and protect the water system in my country against privatization, and opening a conversation about that. And today, Italy is very aware of the importance of water, even if people are. It has been a very important point of how do we say subjectivity, subjectivization. People knowing what is going on, and this is happening all over the world. Last year, I was in Mexico, where there are struggles about water. There have been very famous struggles about water in Bolivia. There are lots of things like there are struggles about water in the United States. Think of what happens in Flint. The water supply system is very important. And my work on the commons, was really bottom up, in the sense that I've seen communities mobilizing to protect fundamental rights, the fundamental right to drink decent water.
Okay? Yes.
The fundamental right to autonomy, not to be under control of some corporation that decide what you can drink or what you can, if you can drink. So my contribution to the commons, the narrative and discussion of the commons worldwide, was to introduce the element of commoning as a struggle. The fact that the commons are not like just resources. Are resources recognized as commons? There is a moment of recognition. There is nothing that is a common per se. Even Dr. Ostrom was still in a quite positivistic mode of thought. There is an out there, then there is the scholar studying the out there, as a scientist would study minerals or something. I was trying to introduce a much more dialectic vision. There is no separation between us and water. We are made of water 80%. So there is no separation between us and the commons. And so we need to understand those things, not just as, kind of objects of observation, but much more spiritual in a way, much more, in a much more pervasive way as part of the way we are. Okay, and so that was what I did in that paper on the preliminary thoughts of the commons. It was a paper that I delivered somewhere in Northern Europe. I don't remember if it's in Germany or in Belgium or wherever. And it was about understanding that the commons is us. Okay, is something that has a very practical, unavoidable practical and activist dimension into it. That's it. And of course, this connects very well to what you want to talk as the last part, which is technology and social media and all of that, because this process of transformation, of commons into capital is also now transforming us people into capital. Okay, because there are no more commons to transform, but the legal structure are always the same. There is a complete freedom of technological experimentation, of economic enterprise, of accumulation of capital, and all of that. And the result is that this transformation of commons into capital is now transforming people into capital. People are becoming commodities themselves, and this is what is happening today with, the big data and the capacity, the tremendous capacity to organize them through algorithms and all the, the structures of basically of maintaining people under control, not with the water now, but with knowledge, which is another common.
Mm. How would you say that the personal devices are being incorporated into that strategy, smartphones and tablets, etc.?
Well, you see, the capitalist extraction, let me call it this way, the institutions of transformation of commons into capital find their most important ingredient and their habitat into individualization. The individual alone is the hero of the liberal vision, the liberal, you know, capitalist vision, you know, the individual owner, the power to exclude, you know, the power to exclude in the most absolute way from your ownership is a very individualizing idea. And even, you know, the structure of power with the chief executive officer, you know, the CEO of the corporation, number one up there deciding everything, the single guy with the full power of decision that decides, very smart and very rich and very efficient and organizes things very well, you know, so strong man in power. And the same thing, you know, this big desire of the strong man in power that is happening throughout the democratic processes of the world, you know, basically the strong man wins everywhere, you know, this narrative is very pervasive. All of that is actually a consequence of a tremendous process of individualization. People are left alone. In the United States, there was a very famous book, The Lonely Crowd, published in the 50s. You know, this vision of we are together, but we are alone. And the smart devices in the last 10 years and the social media, even in less time than that, have been contributing tremendously in making us alone. It's enough if you go on, you know, on public transportation, people don't talk to each other. Mm. People spend all the time chatting with themselves and believing that they are socially connected, but they are socially connected through the smart machines. And by doing, you know, there are these corporations and companies that compete for attention, for keeping people glued to the screen.
Yes.
Tremendously addicted, with no capacity of attention, with no capacity of reflection, and particularly with no capacity to stay together. Okay? And people alone are very easy to govern. People together are very difficult to govern. Mm. Think about trade unions, for example. It's very interesting. In languages such as Italian or French, trade unions are called syndicates.
Yes.
Okay? Syndicate means, in Greek, together with justice. Okay? Syndicato, syndicate, syndaca. Mm-hmm. Syndicate, even in the sense of you use it in English, means together with justice. Mm. The idea is that only if you are together, you can be powerful enough to obtain some economic justice.
Yeah.
Because if you are alone, you're screwed.
That's right.
Okay?
Yeah.
Yeah. and so basically, you know, this technology is making us more and more alone and more depending on it. And we spend, you know, inordinate amount of time. Now, the average time that people spend in front of a screen is 8.8 hour and a half a day.
My gosh.
Which is more than the time we sleep as a species, average time, of 4 billion people in the world. And, you know, and then we inhabit a space, which is the online space, which is inhabited not just by humans, not just by the 4 billion humans, but by another maybe 20 billion smart machines. Because we cannot inhabit them that as human. We inhabit that through a smart device, so we are basically cyborgs once we are over there, and we are at the mercy of machines that are much smarter than ours. Okay, so it's a completely new frontier of human relationship, which is not governed by no law whatsoever, except the law of the smartest, which means the law of the stronger. But that frontier, you know, we assume it as something that exists as such, but in fact itself is the product of power structures. It's the power, is the product of capital concentration. It's the power of military interest. It's the power of, you know, all, is the domain of all these kind of things. And we know nothing about it. And lawyers don't spend time there. And political theorists spend very little time there. There's just a few people that understand what's going on. And those people are the new priests of the new order, you know, which are basically the technologists. So this is an area which is quite scary. I've been studying the last 7 years those things. I haven't basically published nothing yet. I'm still in the process of trying to understand.
I've heard,
and because, you know, a lot of people write before understanding. That's one big problem of academia.
I agree. You know? Yes.
I like to write when I understand, so I don't write on this. I'm starting out talking about it, and sooner or later I will do something. Yeah.
Professor Mattia, I heard you speaking with Ralph Nader a month or two ago. And one of the things that caught my attention during that conversation was a comment you made about social media affecting on-the-ground activism in a very negative way. Could you maybe expand on that a little bit for my listeners?
Sure. Well, you see, this was not a theoretical observation. It was a very practical observation, because 10 years ago, when I did, together with others, the water referendum in Italy back in 2011 was the result. And so we started organizing 2009.
Okay.
And much of that organization was about collecting signatures. And these signatures have to be certified and have to be taken physically. Okay?
Yes.
Then last summer, we started a new campaign nationwide to try to introduce the commons in the civil code. In Italy, we have a civil code system, a civil law system, which is to say that most of private law, what you call the common law, basic relationship, contract, property, tort, they're all codified in a code. Okay, they're not part of the common law tradition. They're part of a written tradition.
All right.
So the idea was, let's put the commons, the definition of the commons, in the civil code, in the law of property, in order to make, to introduce a counter principle in the right in the core of the law that should allow the law to evolve in a different way than it does today. Okay. And so we started collecting signatures for the introduction of the commons in the Italian civil code. It's something that politicians should do, but politicians don't do that. So the only way to do it is through the people, because nobody has interest in giving power to people in the law, you know. And it was very different, you know. What we found out there was that people were not capable, not patient anymore, not capable of staying together. They would not stay more than 3 minutes in a line to wait for signing. Everybody was in a hurry all the time, even on Sunday morning at 11. People was very, very incapable of saying, okay, let's see at 6 o'clock in this particular point and be 10 people there, because everybody now is used to do what? To do whatever they want in the moment they want. This is the great gift of the internet, right?
Yeah.
You can, at 2 o'clock in the morning, you can go out there and book your air flight.
Yeah.
It used to be that you had to go in a travel agent that was open from, you know, 8 to 5 or something. You had much more limits.
Yeah.
Much more limits of stuff you could actually physically do.
Yeah, for
and
everything.
There was a sense of a physical of a physical limit. Now there is nothing of that. So you can, you know, chat with your smart device, you know, at 4 o'clock in the morning, you feel sleepless, you start chatting, and there is someone in a chat with you from somewhere, you know, that spend time with you that you think is your friend. So all of that is a surrogate of the actual, you know, flesh and blood relationship that is necessary for political action. And so that impact was very bad, because, you know, social movements have been about doing stuff together. We are all kind of, we've been all transformed into spinsters, you know, as we used to say. So you arrive at home and you have your own thing. There is nobody you have to, you know, care about. everything you. It becomes an extremely egotic and autistic kind of life.
Yeah.
And egotism and autism in politics are very are a big problem because people cannot connect. Okay.
Right.
And the social media create huge incentives to do that. And these huge incentives actually end up having a devastating impact on participatory politics. And participatory politics is basically where, you know, where activism happens, where social movements can perform by doing stuff together. That is happening it's not happening at all. It's happening much less. You might have like 3 days in which millions of people go in the ground, but, you know, that kind of sustained long struggle are very difficult to happen. And there are areas in which they happen, but where they happen is not because of the social media. You know, where it happens is in Hong Kong, where, you know, or in places like that, where there is a lot of physicality going on and very little, and the might has been stronger than the capacity of control of the system. So this is a whole kind of different area. But yeah, I think in general it has a bad impact.
Is there a concept of the commons that you might apply to the digital space, to the digital world?
Of course there is. I mean, it's actually one of the areas in which commons discussion became quite mainstream. You know, the creative commons movement and for copyright law and the work of Lawrence Lessig and the example, the most famous example, you know, the Wikipedia as a commons encyclopedia that has defeated the big traditional encyclopedias and all of that. So clearly the internet is a place that is quite fascinating because it's very contradictory. On the one hand, it has big promises of emancipation. On the other hand, it's not delivering so much. But certainly the commons became much more of a concept of political activism because of the fact that the internet shows the power of the commons in a way. But you see, there is always a danger, which is the danger of concept being hijacked. Guy Debord, a very important author in France in the 60s, used to talk about the détournement, when a concept becomes spectacularized and carries a meaning that is opposite from the original sense of it. And so all the categories of the political in the current spectacular age, in the current phase of the world, are at risk of being spectacularized. So they become successful, and the moment they become successful, they become very weak. Think about ideas such as the green economy, you know, the Green New Deal, or all this kind of stuff. You know, they become all of a sudden they become so to say buzzwords. But the moment they really become buzzwords, they stop biting, or even worse, they bite the opposite way. So this is where the critical thought is necessary, and this is where we need to go at the deep roots of phenomena. This is why I believe, you know, intellectuals get their salaries. I'm in the very privileged position of being a tenured professor because my job should be to ask the deep and tough questions and to go and look at stuff where other people don't look at.
Yeah.
And that's very important. And behind the whole social media and the internet and technology and all the narrative about how freedom and communicate can follow from that, there are structures of power that are very tangible and rooted in, for example, the big cables under the ocean, so the huge servers, so the major consumption of water and energy. There are issues that are very mundane and very much in the physical, tangible world that then reflect on the internet and on the online world, and we don't see them. Mm. They are hidden. There is no, but where the power lies is now there. It is grounded in the foundations of the new capitalist frontier, which is the online frontier. And this is where we have to go and look, and there is where we need institutions of the commons. See, we need to take control of the infrastructures. We need to know what is the ecological price of all of that. We need to stop believing that if you don't, you know, print your email, you are contributing to the environment, or balloony like that. We have to actually understand that communication technology, rather than part of the solution, might well be part of the problem. And we have to connect it. We have to connect the dots. And connecting the dots is the job of someone who is in my line of business, I guess. So that's what I'm trying to do. Are we almost done? Because I'm sorry, but I have actually to go in a little bit.
Well, I've got just pretty much one more question for you. We've got about 10 minutes left So this is what I would say. It seems like a real problem. It seems that the state and the market are locked in some sort of a dance that they can't get out of, and it's symbiotic and it's detrimental to the commons. So let's talk for the remaining time that we have about potential solutions and what you think people might consider. You've had great success in Italy. How can we apply that to other situations around the world?
Well, you see, I think that there is still a very important need of organizing, and there is a need to understand that today, there is the need to understand one thing that is very important, that the institutions of the commons are not based on competition. Whereas the institutions of modernity have competition as the most fundamental aspect. So look at electoral politics, you know, and movement politics. Movement politics is about doing something together, you know, like protesting against water privatization and suggesting a new way to run the water supply system, which is more participatory, for example. See, that is a common project. I did that. I happened to have a leading position in that movement, but I was part of the movement in the sense that we were all together doing something, okay? And that is true of every social movement. You know, social movements are about doing something together, organizing, arranging things, going out there, taking the signatures, doing fundraising together,
right,
okay?
Right.
If then that becomes, so that is impossible to translate into electoral politics, into representative democracy. That is part of what we call participatory democracy. Okay, people commoning in their political action. And then when you start to translate them into electoral politics, you always lose. Why? Because you're trying to transfer something that is structured on cooperation into something that is structured on competition. Okay, you have to select one candidate. And many people want to be the candidate.
Right.
So you start to compete with each other for becoming the candidate. And then once you're the candidate, your movement, your constituency has to compete with another constituency to show that your candidate is better than their candidate. So the whole system is competitive.
Yeah.
Okay? It's a political competition. And social movements, you know, I'm old enough I started doing my political activity always in social movements. I never had experiences in electoral politics. And in every single time in which a social movement is successful, in Italy we had one in 1977, we had now one very important of students in 1983, then we have a variety of different social movements. At that time, at the end of it, there is always someone to say, oh, let's make a political party and run, okay? And invariably, what happens, the result of that is that then you run to people disappear, you run to election, and you lose. Why that? Because social movements cannot be translated into representative politics.
Yeah.
So we need to, but however, the problem with social movements is they are very, you know, they come, they wax and wane. They are very volatile, okay? Maybe you are 5 million people protesting against the war in Iraq, and then after 3 weeks, there is nothing. Think about, you know, Occupy Wall Street, or the M15 in Spain at the time. You know, they all kind of become extremely powerful for a very short period of time, and then they disappear.
Yeah.
Why? Because they are difficult to translate into institutions of the commons. So to me, what is very important now is to work on organizing institutions that have the philosophy of participation into that.
Yes.
So what we're doing now in Europe, and hope in Italy actually at the moment, and I hope that at some point will become a model, is to create a very large corporation of cooperation between generations. We call intergenerational corporation.
Hmm.
It is to say a pact, a cooperation between the present and the future generation, having like billions of shareholders, each one of them having one share, and creating this entity, which we call the Dolphin Corporation, that then is active and has as a purpose the opposite of the purpose of the predatory corporation. So the purpose being transforming capital, this capital we collect together, into commons, into commoning activities, to supporting, you know, commons information, commons struggles, and so on and so forth. So that kind of organization is crucial. Imagine if instead of having 2.5 billion members of Facebook, whose main collective purpose is making Mr. Zuckerberg obscenely rich,
yeah,
because that's the purpose of people on Facebook, we would have a company of 2.5 billion shareholders, each one of them putting a dollar in, whose main purpose, rather than making Zuckerberg richer, is to transform capital into common, is to cure the environment, is to, you know, take care of the homeless, is to do the kind of stuff that are necessary for a civilized and decent world.
Mm.
Okay?
Yeah.
So that is completely possible by intelligent organization of counter-hegemonic institutions. So people have to organize, to start getting together again, starting switching off the television and the smartphone, and starting, you know, in their own communities to get together and to do something very practical, and especially to connect with the many other people that are commoning all over the world, and to try to do that in institutional ways, that is to say, in ways that stay.
Hmm.
Okay?
Yeah.
So we really have to create a counter order in a way, from the bottom up, to cure those kind of excesses that are out there.
Yeah.
So this is, to me, is my recipe. There is no universal one-size-fits-all strategy, but there are a lot of local possibilities to be engaged and to connect as a large network with one system with another, and possibly, you know, to eventually creating a lot of organizations that, rather than behaving as sharks, behave as dolphins, you know, take care of each other.
Yeah.
Dolphins have a different DNA than sharks. Today, you know, the large corporations have a DNA of a shark.
Hmm.
It's their nature.
Yeah.
They have to make, you know, short-term, very high profits, making, you know, the shareholder value goes up very fast. But, you know, it's not necessarily so. You can imagine organizations that are sustainable economically, and that they work, you know, rather than as sharks, they work as dolphins. They work in the care of the commons around them.
Yes.
And the care of the people that are part of the corporation. This is to me the frontier.
Yeah, it's a
giving
great
some
metaphor.
Good examples and expanding them.
Hmm. Yeah, wonderful example and a great metaphor. What about upcoming events? Do you have anything that you have on the docket that you'd like to mention that you think might be worthy?
Well, you know, right now I'm afraid that your listeners, I'm going to be active in the next 3 months, practically only in Italy. We are getting there with the introduction of the commons into the civil code, and that is going to be the next battle we are doing, and we're actually doing well. And then there is a lot of other things that are happening here that I will at some point explain. For example, there is, you know, local municipalities are introducing all sort of possibilities to create government institutions at the local level to the local people in Italy by, you know, allowing people to take care of certain kind of things that usually are taken care of by the political organization directly by themselves, of obtaining, for example, buildings that are abandoned in order to be refurbished and run democratically. So there are all sorts of things like that that are coming out as, you know, small practices that are very important, because we need to rebuild some sort of welfare, what we call the welfare of proximity.
Yes.
So this is really where I am engaged. I'm always, you know, I give a lot of talks throughout Europe. The United States, the next time I'm going to be in, is going to be in February. Late February, going to be in the West Coast, in the East Coast, and going to give a few talks in New York, in New Haven, and things like that. But right now, I have no precise addresses.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you very much, Professor Mattei. You're doing extremely important work, and I sure appreciate it. I hope we can talk again sometime. There's a lot of things that are always worthy of conversation, and I know there's a lot of things that we didn't touch on, perhaps.
I really appreciate your time, and I take the opportunity to say hello to all your listeners, and thank you very much for having me on the air, and I hope it happens again. Thank you so much.
Very good. Enjoy the rest of the day.
Bye-bye. Thank you.
Okay, ciao. All right, there you go. The wonderful Ugo Mattei. And I feel just absolutely privileged that we had a chance to talk with him. And yeah, it's Mike. You're listening to Radio Orbit on KOPN Columbia at 89.5 FM. Let's get a piece of music on here, and I'll come back and wrap things up in just a few minutes. Once again, it's 89.5 FM, Radio Orbit, back in a few minutes.